Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope everyone had a great weekend. Sagar and I had a blast in Atlanta for the Breaking Points live show. Sold out crowd and got to meet a bunch of you. Always come say hey if you're at one of those things. It was a real fun time talking with people who've been listening to the show ever since the beginning. Today's episode is one I've been excited to do for a while. I spoke with the New York Times' David Phillips. He is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting, and he is the author of Alpha, Eddie Gallagher, and The War for the Soul of the Navy SEALs. The book came out last year when I first read it, but it's now out in paperback, and it is definitely one of the books that I most recommend for Realignment listeners. Obviously, we're focusing a lot on the war in Ukraine, China, forward-looking parts of U.S. foreign policy, but a series that I'm consistently happy to do is a discussion of the past 20 years, especially relating to the war on terror. And David's reporting on challenges that the Navy SEAL community has faced and just the general way that the war on terror has played out at this level, away from hype-filled Hollywood movies, is incredibly helpful. David has also done some really great reporting recently, however, on struggles the SEALs have had, from the Gallagher case to the recent drugs and cheating scandal at Buds. He's also written about how the United States military is struggling to meet its recruiting goals in its post-war on terror, post-COVID environment. It's a complicated topic that David provides some nuance here around, so this is definitely an episode that's going to be up everyone's alleys. I will say, if you enjoy this episode, or any particular episode, or newsletter, YouTube video, anything we put out, we'll have you to go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. You could also go to the show notes, click the link at the very top of the episode's description in your podcast player or on YouTube. All that said, huge thank you to Lincoln Network, our sponsor. Hope you all enjoy this episode. Dave Phillips, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me on.
It's really great to talk with you. We're going to speak about Alpha, your book about the Navy SEALs. Came out a year ago, was honestly one of my favorite reads of 2021. So I really want to throw folks to purchase the book, but I want to cover a couple stories that you've really written about in the New York Times as a military correspondent over the past year that really lead into the overall dynamic that plays out in Alpha. So I want to start here with a question. I'd like to talk about the military enlistment troubles the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force are going through. I would like to speak about the recent scandals in Buds with Navy SEALs cheating, drug testing, questions over whether the course has just become sadomasochistic relative to what it's actually supposed to produce. And then obviously, finally, Eddie Gallagher. How much are all of these stories the result of the hangover from the war on terror and 20 years of those different conflicts? Like, would let's say there's a world where, and I'm going on really long here, but I want to set this up properly. Let's say there's a world where September 11th just doesn't happen and the military just continues on. Are these problems going to happen anyways?
Yeah, man, that is a great question. And like, isn't it amazing to try and imagine where we would be if 2001 hadn't happened? Like, basically, my whole career has been reacting to those terrorist attacks on September 11th in one way or another. So would we be in a different place militarily? Like, hell yeah, for sure. And of course, we don't know how, right? But there's a couple things going on, and some of them are probably directly tied to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and some are not. So, like you said, the military is having a heck of a time getting people to enlist. And I think part of that is that we have an economy that, at least until recently, was doing really, really well. Wages were going up. There were two jobs for everyone who was looking for a job. And a lot of entry-level jobs were providing some of the types of enticements that used to distinguish the military. You know, help with college, help with debt forgiveness, things like that. So all of a sudden, joining the military, unless you really saw it as a calling, seemed like less sweet of a deal, you know, economically. So that was going on. The other thing that the Pentagon has been wringing its hands over for 20 years is that we as Americans are slowly getting less fit, and smoking more pot. I'm not sure if this will come as like any surprise to all listeners, but that has huge implications on the military, because there's really strict requirements on, hey, if you want to enlist, you have to have certain physical fitness standards, and you have to have a clean record in terms of drug use. And that's not just pot. I was kind of joking around, but even stuff like medications that used to be rare and now are somewhat common for anxiety disorders or ADHD, those can still be big roadblocks. So there are a few people who are, able to enlist if they want to, and there are a few people that want to. Now, all of that is separate from everything that happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. So let's put Iraq and Afghanistan on top of that. If you're a young person who wants to enlist, if you're 18 at this point, you've grown up with these wars as the background the whole time. And you saw both of them end pretty badly. And I think that even the smartest people in the country have had a real time, hard time articulating whether we accomplished anything. So it's pretty much the opposite of 2001, when the United States was attacked and people really felt a calling to do something and react. Now it's just like, why would you join the military? That's a much more complex question. And certainly there are tons of people who still want to serve their country, see it as a calling and a duty and the right thing to do. It's an amazing thing to meet those folks. And a lot of them are super cool people, but there's certainly less of that than there was. So you pile all these factors on, and there's just fewer people who are dying to join the military. And that's making things pretty tough.
And what really makes your reporting so vivid is the reality that the enlistment rate is the lowest it's been since the Vietnam War and the formation of the all-volunteer military. So once again, as someone who was in fourth grade during 9/11, I am about as young as you could be and still remember 2004, 2005, 2006. You think of Channing Tatum's failed stop-loss movie, references we're going to throw out there from the 2000s, but I would think that would have been the height of, wow, the military cannot get enough people to enlist. But the fact that right now is such a disaster is really fascinating. Something I'd love to wonder if you've really thought about is, I put a lot of thought towards the post-Vietnam era. So the army immediately afterwards, you've got massive drug problems, you have all the demoralization issues you have now, but like, let's 10X that, because 10X number of soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors were killed during that war. You have, at a baseline level, a society that's much less receptive to veterans. The army and the military overall is able to come back from that. And then, just 10 years later, it's Top Gun and it's the 80s and everything's great. To what level of confidence do you have that a similar story will play itself out? We're at the bottom point of the hangover. Saigon has fallen. Kabul has fallen. But there are underlying strengths that these institutions have, and they will be able to overcome these challenges.
Man, that's a good question. It is pretty remarkable that, like, by the end of the 80s, you have such a sort of hoorah sort of feeling for the military that, like, I was in middle school when we invaded, or I guess liberated, Kuwait. And that was just like the biggest, patriotic rally. I didn't notice it at the time because I didn't know any different, but it was just like, it was such a victory lap after what happened in Vietnam. And I wonder if that dynamic will always be there in the United States. This idea that, like, yes, we can do things as a nation militarily, and whatever happened in the past was an anomaly, and when we get another chance, we're going to take it. We often forget, but we also sent, like, Reagan sent like 8,000 troops into Grenada. And like, at the time, that this is like, I don't remember the year exactly, let's say 88-ish. At the time, that was seen as like, yes, we're finally over Vietnam. And there was this like undercurrent of like, let's get over it. And maybe that undercurrent is still here. And so we will be having this conversation years from now about like, yeah, you know what, that was different. Vietnam or Afghanistan was just Afghanistan. Everyone loses there. This is going to be different. So I don't know. But certainly, like, the institutions, I think, are actually pretty healthy. When I write about the military, what I have to tell non-military readers is it's It's not what you think. It's not a Rambo movie. It's actually more like a giant university because the military is super, super young. Most people join around 18 and they stick around for about 4 or 5 years. So a lot like a giant university. You get a couple people who stick around longer and very few that actually make it a career, you know, i.e. like the professor analogy. But like they're much younger. Because of that, they're much more diverse. Their political views are much more in line with 20-somethings than there are with voters, you know. And like I think that they don't worry about the military nearly as much as the old policymakers who are like, oh my gosh, how are we going to get people to join? I think these are robust institutions that have support in place for people to make a career there. It's so funny because the military, it's pretty conservative, you know, culturally and values wise. But it's also the closest thing to a socialist state that you'll find in North America. They have free education, universal health care, universal employment. Like, you know, like everybody has housing and childcare. It's the type of thing that, like, you know, if Vermont could do it, it would blow their mind. Mm-hmm. They can't. But Fort Hood does it. And so, like, those are powerful and healthy institutions that are still able to find people to join. I do think that they're really looking at this shortage of manpower and thinking, okay, how do we do the same mission with fewer people through automation, through other things, you know? But that's every industry now. That's not unique to the military. And we'll see how it shakes out. I think it's too soon to say.
You know, it's interesting because going back to that 1970s story, a big change that brought about that 80s Army was abolishing the draft, becoming an all-volunteer force. I'm curious what you think about the, we need to bring back the draft discourse. It kind of actually exhausts me usually, because if you study the military, if you speak to like military leadership, the draft was a disaster for the armed forces. It plays a huge role in I think we would have lost Vietnam if we were an all-volunteer force too. But in terms of the dissolution of the Army itself, the discipline problems, you know, read anyone writing about what it was like to be a junior officer in 1976, 1975, and they will tell you horror stories. That's also where the very strident anti-drug policies obviously come from. There's a conversation to be had about marijuana, but like most things come from something and aren't just purely a bunch of, you know, a-holes trying to make everything tough for folks. But the big change then obviously is becoming an all volunteer force. Like, do you think, what do you think about the draft discourse in terms of a broader American society? But B, when you talk to folks, do you think there's any type of like big systemic structural change that one can make like that? That isn't going to fix everything right away. The Army wasn't fixed in 1979, but it had the seeds of some type of renewal.
Yeah. Well, I don't know of anyone who's serious about, like, seriously looks at the problem of manning the military who's talking about a draft. I mean, they keep the infrastructure in place in case of a national emergency. And, like, that's a good thing, because I would have said it was impossible that Russia would invade a modern, sovereign country a year ago, but here we are. I think it's good that we keep that readiness in place, but no one's really talking about it. They're talking about how do we reach the people we want to reach and how do we incentivize them? You know, so essentially they're talking about the same thing that like Google or Amazon are talking about in hiring. It's tough and you got to figure out how to reach people. I think they want to look, there's all sorts of ideas out there about like, how do you bring in more people? And the biggest untouched resource, honestly, is women. Because I don't know if you know this, but there's a ton of women out there and very few of them join the military, even though, you know, a lot of them are very, very qualified, very motivated, make great employees and completely, despite a lot of our ideas of what the military is, like fit into what that mission is. And so, you know, they're looking at all sorts of people that they want to reach that they haven't been good at. But certainly that's a huge untapped part of the population that, like, I mean, if you could get 5% more women interested in the military, like you should pretty much like solve your manning problems for almost all of your needs.
Something I'm curious about is how you think these existential seeming debates about the state of the military, how they relate to the U.S. culture war. So I'm sure you remember towards the start of the Ukraine war, you had, you know, Senator Ted Cruz like tweeting out the Russian ad where it's a buff, like hyper-masculine Slavic looking dude who's just ready to go. And then he's contrasting it with a, I don't know, like kind of silly cartoon where it's a young woman, to your point, talking about how the army is providing almost like, it's like, that's why I like you comparing it to college. It was like what a good state school would put together to advertise to its students. Totally. It's like, you want to go to the University of Oregon, like here, you're going to find yourself and you're going to learn. And once you leave, because you're going to leave eventually, you're going to get a great job. Total contrast. But then obviously we see over the next 3 months, the Russian army is a sack of garbage, to use really technical terminology. Right. So we saw a gap between dunking on that. What do you think about this?
Like old men, like worrying about how like young men are wussies these days. Like that's been going on since at least Teddy Roosevelt and probably since like Beowulf, right? like that's an old story. And what does Ted Cruz know about serving in the military?
Well, here's the question then, though. The question is, if my generation is too overweight to serve, there seems to be something. It's kind of a weird, right? I guess here's the real beef then. It's one thing to beef with the millennial generation. It seems like people are displacing that beef onto the armed forces themselves.
Sure.
So I think the key thing, and this is, I think, part of what leads to the frustration that we'll get into with Eddie Gallagher's generation and the Navy SEALs. There's so much frustration with how the war on terror turned out. But from my understanding, that never came down to individual or unit troop performance.
Right.
This isn't like U.S. troops are getting routed in the field.
Well, and that was one of the craziest things. You had like 10,000 small victories that ended in a defeat. And how does that happen? Well, it's like problems of planning and strategy. And what the hell were we doing in the first place? You know, but I think that's absolutely so true, and something that is so hard for veterans to put their mind around, because they, you know, guys who deployed and, you know, worked really hard, sacrificed, made really tight relationships with people and felt like they did good. You know, they have no shame with those actions, but then they'll look at things and Iraq and Afghanistan and be like, man, what a waste. Like we achieved nothing. And it's hard to like get your head around that. I got two cats.
We could edit it out.
I got two cats that are both in here, but they don't like each other.
You could tell.
All right, now we're down to one cat. That should be.
Yeah, it's good decoration.
So yeah, then, now we're talking to the bad cat only.
Okay, so we've really summarized the recruitment retention challenge there. I'd like you to speak about the Navy SEALs, because what we just ended the section on is frustration with military performance and the real difference between tactics and strategy there. But it seems like if there was a sweet spot, a positive story to be told about the war on terror, it was the performance of special operations across every single branch. So everything from, you know, pararescue jumpers in the, you know, in the Air Force, to like MARSOC in the Marine Corps, Green Berets, Navy SEALs. I was, you know, at the White House in 2011, right when Osama bin Laden died. And that whole moment is about the triumph of the Navy SEALs. You get American Sniper, Act of Valor, Lone Survivor, that whole huge canon. The quickest way to become a major podcaster is to become a Navy SEAL, apparently. There's something going on there, too. But
good way to get really good paying, like corporate leadership speaking gigs, too.
It's true. And
let me tell you how to run your company like a SEAL.
And I think that really speaks to, if you just went to sleep, let's say in 2015, and woke up and read both your book and your reporting, you'd be shocked at where things turned out, at least at a narrative level, with the Navy SEALs. Mm. So can you just tell that story from basically, let's say, the killing of Osama bin Laden, the real hype period, to the troubles that start emerging in 2017?
So the Navy SEALs, we all know at this point, like, what they are, who they are. They're sort of the top tier direct action commando force in the military. The guys who take on those really tough, really critical counterterrorism missions. You know, they're the guys who rescue hostages from Somali pirates, or sweep in the middle of the night and assassinate Osama bin Laden. Like these, like laser precise strikes that are really important, and probably the like polar opposite of the let's invade and occupy all of Afghanistan and try and make it work type of idea, right? These are precision, lightning fast, not years long projects in nation building. And, you know, because of that, despite the like many failures of the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, these guys were seen like as the good guys, the white knights, the guys who could get stuff done even when everything else seemed to be falling apart. And I think that the American public really loved them for that. You know, here was just evidence that despite everything that was falling apart, our nation could still like achieve our goals. And pop culture just embraced that in so many different ways. There were, like you mentioned, blockbuster movies and best-selling books and podcasts and products. And these guys like rose into corporate America after they got out, and they're just seen as like sort of like, you know, ninjas of executing plans, you know, whether that's at Exxon or, you know, in the mountains along the Pakistan border. And because everything was secret, because everything's classified, and the only people that ever got to tell these stories were SEALs themselves, like they got to build this myth that didn't include any of the reality. And I was always interested by that, but I'd never found a way in until this Navy SEAL named Eddie Gallagher got arrested for murder. And all I knew at that point, I had zero like hunch about whether he was guilty or not, is all I knew is this guy who's done a bunch of combat tours, you know, is about my age and been fighting the war on terror for 15, 17 years, now is in jail for killing an enemy, and he was turned in by his own guys. So whether he's guilty or not, something really interesting happened here. And a bunch of SEALs are going to have to get up on the stand in public and talk about it. And for the first time, I'm going to get a sense of like, how does a SEAL platoon really work when they're overseas? Who are these guys? What, you know, what is their beef with their leader? And why was he doing what they said he did, if he was? And so I just sort of like decided, okay, you know, sit down, strap in, and just like watch this very carefully, because no matter what happens, we're going to learn something.
So the question then is, what, who was that? This is the right way to set this up. Like, who was Eddie Gallagher relative to the myth you want to describe of the Navy SEALs?
Yeah. So the myth of the Navy SEALs is it's sort of these selfless, nameless operators who are the absolute top of their game, you know, almost like, you know, Jason Bourne quality fighters. And the reality was something really different. Eddie Gallagher was a guy who barely made it through high school, scored really low on his military aptitude tests. Once he got into the SEALs, was sort of a serial screw up, and was repeatedly admonished. But the SEALs was this really insular brotherhood, you know, that looked out for each other. And if you had friendships, if you were seen as a good dude, people might overlook things, smooth things over, write you a good recommendation, help you along. And so Eddie, despite like repeated failures, eventually mid-career, got put in charge of a platoon of about 20 guys and got worked his way into a really plush assignment. And this is a weird thing about the SEALs. So his plush assignment was in 2017 to get sent into the middle of Mosul, Iraq, which was occupied at the time by ISIS, you know, and was going to be, all of them knew it, just an enormous vicious fight. So most of us would want nothing to do with that. But in the SEALs, those guys are so determined to you know, get some action. Like the worst thing that can happen to them is to sit out in a fight like that. So he was able to, with his platoon, get a chance to go there. And once he got there again, it was kind of a shit show, kind of the same pattern of bad decisions and poor leadership that he'd shown for a long time. And, you know, his guys, at first they wrote it off as having a horrible boss. You know, a lot of times, most of us have probably had a horrible boss that sometimes you try and ignore the crazy stuff they say and just sort of get through and do what you have to do. And they did that for most of this deployment, but then he killed, or at least they say, we should say he was acquitted. They say that he killed a captive right in front of them. And likely they say killed a number of civilians who he shot at from a sniper hide. And they just couldn't ignore that type of stuff. I mean, being a bad boss is one thing, being a murderer is another. And they turned him in, which goes completely against the ideas of their brotherhood. Their brotherhood is very much, it's almost like saying the mob is too extreme, but it's very closed and has a deep understanding.
Can I add something? Reading the book, one of the prosecutors, I believe, or an NCIS official makes reference to it being like investigating a gang.
Yeah.
In terms of like that. So it's not the mob, but it's like a gang in the sense of the standards and the expectations, the tightness, like that part.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea that you don't turn each other into the authorities for sure. You know, and maybe they think of themselves a little bit like a gang too, because they're playing a game that most Americans don't play and understand or believe that rules shouldn't apply, you know? And so if, yeah, technically the rules say you can't kill an ISIS captive, like who cares to a certain extent, like whoever made up those rules has never been here, I think is some of the thinking. And they tried to protect, you know, a guy who'd been deployed many times, but maybe a guy who didn't deserve protection.
So let's get to the, and actually speaking of the reference to the initial question of like how much of this is due to the war on terror, to your point in the book, he only got into the SEALs after multiple times after by 2004, 2005, I don't want to say desperate because it's incredibly difficult to become a Navy SEAL, obviously, mm-hmm. but there is a relaxation of that criteria. Is that a correct way of putting it, given the needs that were on the ground in Iraq in 04, 05?
I think it's fair to say that they needed to rapidly expand the number of men in the SEAL teams, and more people got through. Eddie was one of them, and he hadn't been able to get through before. So he may be a legacy of those policy decisions for sure.
So here's what I want to understand here, given the story you're telling in Alpha, but also just your recent reporting on the struggles within the SEALs. It's been getting harder and harder and harder and harder to make it through BUDS, to make it through that initial selection and to become a Navy SEAL. I think the statistics where it was a 40% pass rate in the 70s and 80s, now in some squads, it's below 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously there are folks who defend those standards, will defend the increasing difficulty. How are we seeing the actual results in terms of performance? Because something you talk about, like during the invasion of Grenada, there are all sorts of issues with the SEALs. And they're actually, and this is a really interesting part of the history that I had no idea about, like the post-Vietnam Navy SEALs. So that 20-year period, there actually are a lot of disasters. There's a lot of like corruption. So you could argue on the one hand that as things have gotten much more competitive and there's been more spotlight on the SEALs, obviously you have like the Eddie Gallagher's of the world, mm-hmm. but you also have like the SEALs as a institutional, at an effectiveness perspective, doing better than ever. How would you adjudicate like the thing?
Well, so I mean, it's because I report on the SEALs, I've gotten to know a lot of active duty SEALs really well, guys that are important background source of mine. And these are like amazing individuals. I'm reminded all the time, like smart, motivated, and like really tough, not just like pretend to be tough, just tough mothers, man. And I appreciate knowing that they're there. And at the same time, there are guys in there interacting with them who are like almost criminals. And so you have this weird dichotomy where it's both. But back to your question about selection, here's what's really wild about it. as you said, the number of people who are able to get through BUTS has gone lower and lower and lower over the years. And it's not an even line. It goes up and down. But generally speaking, it has gotten harder. And that's incredible because at the same time, the Navy has done all sorts of stuff to try and make it easier, or at least make it so that more people pass. There's now, you know, several months of preparation and screening that these guys go through before the first day they even step into the Navy BUDS program. That didn't happen in the 80s when 40% of people were getting through. You just showed up on the beach and hoped you made it. So these guys are really in shape. They've been specifically selected to try and predict whether they have the toughness, and yet fewer are getting through, which is kind of crazy. And the offshoot of that is something really disturbing. That's that people have realized it's so hard to get through now that really if you're smart, what you should do is cheat. You should start using performance enhancing drugs, testosterone, human growth hormone, other things that I had never even heard of before I started writing about
Viagra for what was it?
Right?
What does the Viagra do again, or supposed to do?
A lot of these guys get pulmonary edema, fluid in their lungs, and Viagra changes the sort of the your vessel pressure. Essentially. And so, yes, it can affect all sorts of things. But in addition, like, it can affect the little air sacs in your lungs and keep that fluid out. At least that's the thinking of the SEALs. But yeah, so people are cheating. And so you have this program that's become hard, and they want it to be hard so you can select the right people. But a twist came where it's now so hard that it's selecting for cheaters. And that's problematic in any situation. I mean, if you think about sports, right? You don't want cheaters to win, but it's particularly problematic when the people you're talking about are going to do the must succeed precision strikes, and the name of their game is killing, right? If you have guys who can't make an ethical decision in training, and you have to make really hard ethical decisions with lethal force, I think there's a lot of people in the Navy who think that's going to come back and bite you.
No, and this is such a fascinating story, because it's a cascade of forces and, let's say, bad decisions that build up. Because once again, Lance Armstrong, really bad call doping, but we don't then basically give Lance Armstrong a license to kill.
Right.
So that's what happens if you're a SEAL. But on top of that, there's then the cultural aspect here. Because this comes out in your reporting, this happens on some of the, you know, New York Times comments in reply to your story. Oh, you're a civilian. Oh, these are the guys, the watchmen, you know, on the tower. Think of, you know, Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men. You All want right. us on that wall. You're not fit there, which is an argument. And I think there's many ways that can manifest itself on the battlefield as completely legitimate. But you have to then understand, and this is, I think, the most important part of the book, that creates enormous accountability issues when it comes to the judicial process, when it comes to reporting, when it comes to the rules of war, all of those bits. So so just from what you've perceived here, like, how, what are thoughts you've come across on how you keep a culture like that accountable? If we are to say all of these things,
right,
how does that really work?
Right. So, like, I think that the one thing that pretty much the majority agrees with is this is not training that you want to be easy, but it is training that you want to be fair. The students going into that training feel that way. I think the majority of SEALs feel that way. I think that the majority of the public feels that way. Like, you need a bare knuckle selection process if you're going to, you know, find the dangerous men who need to do dangerous things. But how do you keep it from becoming a gang, right? Because if the only people are getting through are drug users and cheaters, and they all kind of know that that's the deal, and they all are covering
One quick thing that speaks to the battle for the soul part of the Navy SEALs, part of your book. Your argument isn't that everyone's a cheater. Your argument that there are two different cultures within the Navy SEAL. So the term you use are pirates. There are pirates who can exploit those situations. Then there are people who are, you know, going by the straight and narrow. So the question is, what do you do if your selection process
favors the pirate?
Favors the pirates. Just to, so we can go on. I think that's an important distinction.
For a long time, there has been this sort of like yin and yang type of struggle between the pirates and the Boy Scouts. The pirates thinking like, look, war is a dirty business and you have to fight dirty in it. And the Boy Scouts, who maybe I'd describe as saying like, look, if you don't follow the rules, then you're no better than ISIS. You know, if we are killing ISIS captives, how is that any different from them capturing us and beheading us on YouTube? There's no difference. And that struggle has certainly never been resolved. But if there's fundamental problems in the training pipeline where you're selecting for people who are like, the rules are meant to be broken and no one understands us, you probably, over the long term, favoring the pirates.
And let's talk about the history then. So the Navy, well, they weren't, I guess, technically Navy SEALs in World War II.
Yeah, but let's call them frogmen. They're all frogmen. Yeah,
the frogmen. So so basically, I think there are two, to understand this pirate versus Boy Scout dynamic. And even the term Boy Scout is such a, it's a disaster. That's a disaster. This wasn't chosen by anyone.
Well, I think it was used as like an epithet.
Yeah, it's an epithet. So I'm like, I don't know. I kind of want a pirate.
Yeah.
And I was like, look, if I had to choose, I'd choose the pirate, which is probably like not good at a societal level, obviously. But so there are two histories that folks probably don't know but are useful for understanding both ends of this sphere. So what is happening in World War II that leads to this unique culture, the frogmen, the pre-Navy SEALs, who are basically allowed to not dress the same way as other Navy, so the sailors are allowed to treat their officers in a very fraternal matter as opposition to like a normal enlisted person. What's that history? Then we'll get into Vietnam and the pirate culture.
Yeah, so the frogmen in World War II were basically the guys who had to swim to the beach and figure out, is this beach deep enough for us to actually land at? Because if you try to land 10,000 troops on Normandy and you realize that you hit sand a mile out, you are majorly screwed. So they literally had guys with little pieces of slate and strings to like swim into enemy waters and measure how deep it is, write it down, report back. And these guys also were the first wave of the invasion, because they need to go in and clear, usually by using explosives, clear any obstacles that were in the way to keep landing ships from coming in. It was extremely dangerous stuff that they did with no weapons. The only thing these guys carried was a little knife. You know, you couldn't swim with a firearm. And so they were viewed by the rest of the Navy as completely nuts. Like, just like, it was the most wild, dangerous, difficult job you can imagine. Go over the edge of the boat into the cold water, swim to enemy shores with no weapons, take these measurements under fire, blow up some obstacles, swim back. That's just crazy. And because of that, they were just seen as like, hey, let them do what they want. These guys, we found these guys who are willing to do it. You know, they're different from all of us. They didn't have any of the really tight discipline that had been developed for centuries on Navy ships. They were just there to go over the side. And if they were willing to do it, kind of who cared? But they really embraced that type of culture. So starting then and still today, in the SEAL teams, you know, a lot of people go by first names and rank isn't really mentioned. The officers train in the exact same training course alongside the enlisted guys. There's much more egalitarianism, and there's much more of an idea of like, hey, whatever the rules of the Navy are, they don't really apply to us because we don't do the stuff that they do. We're different. You know, they're ship drivers, we're commandos.
It's funny, and the way you write the book really illustrates this. Like, if you know anything about the military, anytime an enlisted sailor calls the officer Jake, that whoa, Jake, no, Jake, this is the lieutenant who's nominally in charge here. It's and once again, this adds to the dynamic, because part of the reason why you have, because if you kind of think about it for a second, the idea of like officer and enlisted feels very, if you're just explaining it to a civilian, feels kind of antiquated. So wait, like, these guys who have college degrees, they have more responsibilities. Why is this like ensign or this lieutenant junior grade nominally in charge of a 20-year veteran? That doesn't make any sense. But part of the reason why it's there is there are structural and organizational reasons why that would be true, and why that system persists beyond just like the obvious. So can you talk about that aspect of that culture breaking down in the story you're telling here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is uncommon in the SEAL teams, the platoons that actually like do the work. Most of the time, the top enlisted, the chief, really is running the show, and to a certain extent, the officer is there to help him out with some of the bureaucracy. You know, clear the lane so that the chief can make things happen, and he's deciding what to do. To a large extent, he's telling the guys what to do, and especially in Eddie Gallagher's platoon, the officer was. He was really marginalized. You know, he didn't have a lot to say.
I think this comes to, I hope a takeaway that listeners who are at this point in the show can really realize is there's a lot of incredibly complicated dynamics that civilian, you know, leadership of the Navy has to sort out, that like individual platoons need to sort out. It seems what makes all of this just turn into an actual disaster is frankly like Donald Trump and what he decided to do when it came to all of these incredibly complicated issues. So the issue of did Eddie kill the prisoner in self-defense? Like, was there a prisoner? Was there a breakdown of discipline within the actual unit? How should the SEALs balance these legitimately competing instincts? Donald Trump and Fox News, frankly, and this sounds super partisan, but this is really why I want people to read the book. This is literally what happens here. Fox News, Donald Trump jump in and bowl in a China shop, all of the nuance there.
Right.
What am I basically referring to in terms of what actually goes down?
So Eddie Gallagher's on trial, like sitting there awaiting trial for murder. And first Fox News, but then members of Congress and then eventually the president start like tweeting support for him, essentially sometimes appearing with his family on the Capitol steps in the case of a couple of Congress people. And, you know, what that does is this gets kind of boring, but it's so important. Like due process in the courts and presumption of innocence and just letting the actual evidence be presented is so important. And instead, people who had never seen the evidence had no interest in due process were getting up there and just saying like, well, this guy's being like mistreated. And that's really dangerous when it's the president, because the president's also the commander in chief. So he's the boss of the people who have called for and are putting on the trial. And so in a way, he's putting his thumb on the scale, right? If you're the prosecutor who's a sailor in the officer in the Navy, if you're the commander, he's your boss, you know? And so there's real questions about due process. Now, Eddie Gallagher was basically acquitted of everything. Imagine he was convicted. He would have been able to probably successfully appeal his case for undue command influence because these people, the president, were in there saying like, well, I don't think what's right is going on, and essentially throw in the whole case. But he was also creating this rift with the military where he was saying, hey, for seemingly political reasons, I'm going to interfere with this because my base likes it. My base likes that this guy killed or is at least accused of killing a terrorist. And if you have a problem with that, I don't really care. I'm the president. And so that puts the military in a really tough situation because they either have to follow their chain of command, the commander in chief, or they have to follow the regs. But you can't do both. Or at least like it's creating really, really tough tension. And you do that enough times, it turns really dangerous because either the military is willing to go along with you and to hell with the rules, that's a bad situation, or they're not willing to go along with you, civilian leader, and they're going to do their own thing. And that's a coup d'etat. So either way, if you start creating that tension, there's really not a good outcome.
Yeah. And it just speaks to, and what I found particularly just tragic about this story from a political perspective is not to speak up for Trump's base here for a second. I think a lot of folks would say it's not even that they approved of the killing of like the young ISIS fighter. they would say, look, this was a warfighter who has been on, you know, the wall for us for 20 years, who's being scapegoated. I mean, this is the argument that the lawyer makes, who says that after all of this, you have an enlisted sailor who's given everything for this, who could go to jail for life, and senior military leadership isn't held accountable at all. So right. it's just really, and if there were to ever be an argument that would be, and this is why it's such a disastrous argument for a politician, namely Trump, to bring into this debate, that has nothing to do with the question of military justice. Well, but that is ultimately a political debate that has no presence in the courtroom. If we want to have a debate about how we should discuss General Tommy Franks when he invaded Iraq,
right,
that has nothing to do with the question of should Eddie Gallagher go to jail for killing someone.
There's something else too. So when the president got involved, and obviously got involved on the side of Eddie Gallagher, it basically sent notice to the whole military that, like, hey, you will not do anything to look at what went wrong here. And so even though there was suggestions of all sorts of failures up and down the chain of command in terms of Eddie Gallagher, there was never any type of command inquiry into what happened. Like the literally, when the Navy wants to figure out what happened, they have to read my book. And I'm not allowed to look at any of their records or anything like that. I had to write it from the outside. But my book is the best record of what happened, because they felt if we ask for an inquiry on this, we'll get hammered. Trump will fire us by tweet. Like it was that tense at that time. And so, you know, it was really forgotten, and lessons that probably needed to be learned, whatever they were, I don't want to presuppose them, but were never even looked at.
And once again, it's hard to even it's hard to find I think this is a good book for, we're obviously, you know, past the first anniversary of the fall of Kabul, and, you know, 21 years after September 11th, I think this book is a good reflect upon the state of things, because there's such a confluence of issues here that it's hard to just say, okay, here is the lesson.
Yeah.
What would you say, though, maybe not lessons, but takeaways for folks when they're thinking? So, for example, a takeaway for me would be civilian leadership deeply needs to have a strong conceptualization of their role within this system. President Trump, his sin here, from my perspective, is he did not have a conception of the system he was interfering in. He just knew that he had political objectives. I think one of the quotes he said to Navy leadership was, "We're getting killed over this.
Yeah.
Why is he not out of jail?"
Yeah.
Aside from just the fact that that's bad from a justice perspective, at a deeper level, there isn't a conception of, okay, so let's say we do this.
Yeah.
What is the cost to overall military discipline when the SEALs themselves are in this difficult transitional state? How is it going to affect these debates? How is it going to affect this cheating, doping scandal? Like, what's your reflection on that?
So when I was close to finishing writing this book, I started reading all these old Raymond Chandler novels. He's the noir mystery writer who wrote The Big Chill and a bunch of other things. And I started to realize, like, oh, this story is really a noir. It's not a murder mystery. Because if this was a murder mystery, it's the worst whodunit you've ever seen. This guy kills a captive in front of a number of eyewitnesses, then gathers his men to take a picture with the dead body, then texts to one of his friends a picture of the dead body saying, basically, I got this guy with my knife. Not exactly Agatha Christie, right? But it was a fascinating story of how that one murder and the things surrounded it revealed sort of like a larger crime, a societal crime, you know, a rot that was many levels deep. Because, like, you know, there was malfeasance in how he went to court. There was malfeasance in how the chain of command tried to deal with things. There's malfeasance in how politicians try to, you know, rather than create good policy and let policies in place run, try to use it for political points. And it was all these noir things that were swirling around the death of a kid that no one you know, didn't even that people didn't even think enough of to even learn his name. And so when I realized that, it really helped me to see like, oh, okay, the story of this is not did he do it or didn't he? The story is, when you inject this toxin into the system, into the body, how does the body respond? And that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's something that your book really helped me interpret as a civilian, the situation with Lieutenant Colonel Stu Schuller or Scheller. So this was the Lieutenant Colonel who, after the fall of Kabul, released videos like very aggressively critiquing U.S. military leadership over the withdrawal. And he was still a Lieutenant Colonel when he did this. A lot of folks who are in this listenership were sympathetic to Colonel Scheller because they saw they had beef with the war, obviously, but they also saw the withdrawal as a disaster. But from my perspective, the second I watched that video, I was like, oh my God, like, this is a Fox News audition. Yeah. It was clearly a Fox News audition. It was clearly a political act. And I think that this is like a degree of like, it's like pornography. You know it when you see it. But I just saw it for exactly what I thought it was. And I think our reaction to those types of moves, going around the chain of command, attempting to work the refs, aka the media, from folks in these politicized situations, I think it really has to be interpreted through that means. So I don't know. It was a tough situation because he ended up getting a lot of trouble. Like he had certifiable issues. It's complicated, but there just has to be a way. Actually, no. But here's my reaction. He should have resigned. He should have resigned, and he could have done that video, and I wouldn't have cared.
Yeah.
But him putting forth those videos in our current political media environment with all these tensions as an active duty lieutenant colonel, that is a line crossed. And I think as a society, we have to basically say that's just it. He wasn't reporting a crime in progress.
Right.
He wasn't saying
he's not refusing a lawful order.
Yeah, exactly. It was after the fact. It was after the withdrawal.
Well, and you make a really good point that like he probably knew it was a serious no, but like legit and probably legitimately felt heartfelt what was happening was wrong, but knew it would be wrong to say it publicly, and probably knew that he would get hammered because of it. And also probably knew in like our grievance-based like media landscape that if he was hammered for it, that would be beneficial to him in the long run, right?
You got a book deal.
If you resign first, then criticize.
Yeah.
And the man doesn't punish you, right?
There's the number of lieutenant colonels who have had critiques with military policy over the past 15 years is legion.
Yeah.
He was prominent because he did that. And that's the frustrating thing, because that so much of this, and this is why I want to do this episode, because civilians such as, you know, myself, obviously are so separated from this debate, like not merely because the funny take is, and this is why I critique the lazy draft discourse. Like if I were drafted at 18 and I served as a supply clerk for 2 years, I don't think I'd feel any more qualified to adjudicate Navy SEAL battles. So I think it's very important that you actually just tell civilians like, hey, there are certain expectations in the military. There are certain cultures in the military. In a civilian-led military, there are responsibilities there, and one has to figure out how to navigate that part.
Yeah, and I think that there's civilian equivalents to a certain extent where like there's just professional behaviors that you have to have if you are going to do that profession, and you recognize that they're like a core part of being able to perform your work. You know, like journalists, we do that all the time, probably not to the extent, but certainly like we have to conduct ourselves and live in a fashion where we're not going to undermine our credibility, because credibility is the coin of our realm, right? So if we can be impartial and credible, like that's really important. And if I tomorrow went online and did a screed about how I, you know, that was deeply political and divisive about something like pulling out of Afghanistan, like I would probably expect to be fired as well.
And I think the way to wrap this question, we've talked a lot about specific challenges. So challenges within, you know, the real, what you could basically say like narratively as like the A team of the U.S. military, like these challenges of enlistment given the economy. But like you referenced, there was a war in Ukraine. There's great power competition. Where would you say things stand moving in? So this isn't a question for a prediction. Where do things stand, like moving into this next era as we pivot away from the Middle East?
You know, I got to be honest, that's not something that I really look at. Like, I always joke, we've got a bunch of people that write about the military in the New York Times. And I always joke that all I do is go around and talk to Joes. Like, we've got people at the Pentagon, we've got people in Ukraine right now, and they're all so good at what they do. And what I'm good at is like finding the real people on the ground who do the work and just trying to listen to them. And so that gives me a perspective that's a lot like their perspective, you know, like where, how has the world changed? Like, who the hell knows? You know, that's their perspective. They just have to be ready for anything, you know? And so, you know, a lot of the SEALs that I talk to and use for sources, they're still, even though we're in peacetime, they're working their asses off doing various dangerous training because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And it's not their job to. Their job is to just be prepared and good at their one part of this much larger thing. And I think that most people, if they went and spent any time with folks in uniform who are actually doing the work, they would be refreshed to see that that's going on all over the place. It's just like people who, like, they know their job, they're trying to make sure they're good at it. They generally just like get along and are a lot like you and me.
And I think that's the hopeful note, because that shows at a certain level, to your point, the institution is doing what the institution needs to do, despite the upheaval and forces and challenges. Well, Dave, this has been really great. I'd love for you just to shout out the title of the book. It's available in our bookshop. You can also go to Amazon or anywhere else. Like I said, I really enjoyed it.
Cool. Yeah. Alpha, the war for Eddie Gallagher and the war for the soul of the Navy SEALs. Funny story. I wanted it to just be the war for the Navy SEALs. They're like, no, it's got to have Eddie Gallagher in it. So I lost that war.
Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.